Today's lecture will be about classical anti-Semitism. The classical anti-Semite figure of Haman in the Book of Esther. However, I'll open with an almost modern anecdote. My father, rest in peace, used to live partially in Brighton on the British seashore on the southern coast, and during the mid-30s he saw a notice that there will be a lecture in the town hall on the alien menace. Being much involved in the problems of the Jewish public, he immediately thought to himself, we must be the alien menace. So he decided to go to the lecture, and he took with an empty wooden fruit box, and he went with one friend, and the lecturer, who was part of the fascist movement of the 30s, a close colleague of Mosley's, at a certain point arrived to the Jewish problem, and he says he has a wonderful solution for the Jewish problem. The solution is extremely simple. Everyone in Britain who has a house should undertake never to sell a house to a Jew, never to rent a house out to a Jew, and that way the Jews will have nowhere to live and they'll just go away from Britain. At that point, my father took his fruit box, stood up. He had a very penetrating Scots accent, and he shouted out at the top of the voice, "Now I understand how it was that Jesus was born in a stable. His mother was Jewish, and no one would give her a place to live in." Coming back to the Book of Esther, Haman is infuriated by Mordechai, who is in fact a court Jew, when he refuses to bow down despite Haman's decree, and he says to himself, in quote number one, he says to himself, to kill one Jew, to deal with one Jew, the Jews are really not worth that. So he has to find a solution how to destroy the entire Jewish people. So he applies to the king, Ahasuerus, Ahasuerus, and he presents a picture of a people, a useless people, scattered all over the republics, the 127 countries that were incorporated into the kingdom of Persia and Media. And he says they're scattered everywhere, they're absolutely useless, they're non-productive, and the king won't lose anything by liquidating them, let's dispose of them. To which, and he adds, there's always a monetary incentive, and he adds, the king shouldn't be worried about losing taxes, because I'll easily be able to deliver 10,000 talents of silver to the royal coffers, and it'll be a profitable enterprise. To which Ahasuerus responds, "Hakesef natun lach, take the money. I don't need the money. Va'am lasot bo ketov benecha, do what you want with the people. The main thing is that I'll get rid of them." Now, the public image is that Haman is the anti-Semite, and that Ahasuerus is a somewhat stupid king involved in beauty contests to choose new wives. But in point of fact, what immediately emerges from the story in Esther is that Haman is not the only anti-Semite. that Ahasuerus is certainly an anti-Semite. He's certainly extremely pleased to be rid of his Jews. But Haman is more active and Ahasuerus is more passive. The Talmud comes along with a parable. And the parable in quote number 2 says the following. To what would I compare Ahasuerus and Haman? To someone who has a ditch in his property. An immense ditch. And there is another party that has a large mound of earth. The owner of the ditch says, "Oh, I'd love to have that mound of earth to fill in my ditch." The owner of the mound says, "Ah, I'd love to be able to use that ditch to get rid of my mound. Can't use my field in the proper fashion." One day, fate decreed that they would meet. And the owner of the ditch says to the owner of the mound, "Please sell me your loose earth." The owner of the mound responds, "Ah, please take it. Please take it. You don't have to pay a thing. I'll be happy to be rid of it." It's a delightful parable. But the question is, what does it mean? What does it add to the original text? We see that Ahasuerus wishes to dispose of the Jewish people as much as Haman. So, what does the parable add? Let's take a look further. Ahasuerus, we said, is not an active anti-Semite, but he has his methods. The sages pose the question, the same page in Megillah, in the Talmud, they pose the question, what cause, since everything is by divine control, what caused this decree against the Jewish people to come about? And the students of Rav Shimon ben Yochai, in fact, in the Medrash says it was Rav Shimon ben Yochai himself who stated this, they postulated that the reason why the Jewish people were condemned in the eyes of God was because they participated in the feast of Ahasuerus. The book of Esther opens with a magnificent feast. This was a feast which had daily floor shows, without doubt. And the moral situation in the kingdom of Ahasuerus was such that even a queen wasn't that privileged. According to the sages, she was invited to appear before all the people who attended the feast in the altogether. And she lost her post because she declined. And the Jews who were keeping the Torah had absolutely no business to be there. Ahasuerus' system was simple. Let's take this supposedly holy people and let's assimilate them and turn them into people just like one of us. Now, is assimilation a solution for anti-Semitism? Let's take a look at a story in the Talmud concerning Rabbi Akiva, one of the greatest of the Talmud, of the Mishnaic Talmudic sages, who, as we will see, gave his life in order to teach Torah. A passage, quote number 4, in Brachot 61b. manifesto of the Jewish people, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad, Hear O Israel, the Lord is God, the Lord is one. The Lord our God, the Lord is one. Continues, you should love the Lord your God, b'chol levavcha, l'chol nafshecha, l'chol modecha, with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your might. With all your soul, explains Rabbi Akiva, even if you have to give your life for the sake of God, that is part of loving God. That's the ultimate act of loving God. And then we are told the following story. We are told that a certain gentleman called Paphos ben Yehuda, Paphos the son of Yehuda, that name needs examination, because Paphos is clearly an assimilated name of Greek origin, whereas Yehuda, Yehudi, is a typical, very, very Jewish name. His father was very Jewish, but he has decided to go to become part of the high society of the Persian royal court. And he finds, or rather, we are not talking of the Persian royal court at this stage, we are talking of the Roman rulers. And he meets Rabbi Akiva, and he sees that Rabbi Akiva, against the decree of the Romans, is teaching Torah to the public. And he says to him, seems they were friends nevertheless, he says to him, Akiva, are you not afraid of the Roman Empire? Are you not afraid of their decrees? So Rabbi Akiva responds and said, I'll give you an example. A parable. A fox was walking on the side of a river, and he sees the fish who are trying to escape the nets which the human beings are spreading to catch them, and they're darting hither and thither, and he says to the fish, you are stupid. You're in the water, in a river, you can be easily caught just by a net across the river. If you want to save yourselves, please come out of the river, come and live with me as our forefathers lived together, and you won't have to worry about the nets of the human beings. To which the fish responds, you fox are supposed to be the cleverest of all the creatures. If in our elements where we can exist, we are afraid for our lives. If we step out of our element into an element that we cannot exist in, should we not be afraid of our lives? Says Rabbi Akiva, this is the Jewish people. You're trying to tell me, Paphos, I should not teach the Torah, the risk is too great, I might be killed. The Torah is the element of the Jewish people. It's the air that they breathe. Without that, they have no proper existence. So if we risk our lives teaching Torah, we'll be much worse off if we do not teach the Torah. We will be completely out of our element. History is ironic, because shortly afterwards, the Talmud tells us, Paphos meets Rabbi Akiva again. Believe it or not, in the Roman prison. Both of them have been captured by the Romans. Rabbi Akiva has been captured by the Romans because he was teaching Torah. Paphos, we don't know why, must have been some kind of misdemeanor. Maybe he bribed the wrong person in the government. But there they are, both in prison. Presumably both are going to be executed. And Rabbi Akiva says to Paphos, I know why I'm here, but what are you doing here? Says Papas to Rabbi Akiva, Ashrecha Rabbi Akiva, you may be happy. You can laugh, Rabbi Akiva, because you're here for something of value. And I am here for Dvarim V'Telim, things of absolutely no value. We don't actually hear what the end of Paphos is, but it's self-evident. But history has forgotten Paphos. There is a tremendous irony in what happens to Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva is taken out to be executed. The Romans gather together all his students. He is going to be the example that convinces them all that the Torah must be forgotten, the Torah can no longer be taught. Rabbi Akiva is tortured by the Romans, and in the midst of the torture, Rabbi Akiva is saying, Shema Yisrael, hear O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. By the way, this is the source of the well-known fact that so many Jews died in the Holocaust with that verse on their lips. And his students ask him, Akiva, does a man have to go so far that in the midst of his being tortured to death, that he has to accept upon himself that God is king? To which Rabbi Akiva responds, all my life I was pained, I was worried. When would the possibility of offering my life for the love of God, even if he's taking your life, when would I be able to fulfill that? And now that the opportunity comes, should I not utilize it? Should I not fulfill it? What does this mean? Does this mean that a person has to live waiting for the moment that he will finally be executed for the glory of God? Does it mean that? Of course not. What it does mean is that, as it is explained by Rav Yerucham Leibovich, who was the spiritual lecturer of the Mir Yeshiva in Poland, what it does mean is, a soldier, when you see soldiers, you never know who is really courageous and who is a coward till the moment of battle. Rabbi Akiva is not requesting to die being tortured for the sake of God. What he was saying was, he was afraid that if he would be tested, that he might not be able to stand the test. And now he says to his students, I see that I can. In a sense, he's almost happy with his tests. Extraordinary to say. The irony of history is simple. The Romans wanted to blot out the teaching of the Torah. But Rabbi Akiva's death was so inspiring to his students that it guaranteed that they would continue in his way. And Paphos, the assimilationist, he's just disappeared. No one's ever heard of him. He has no historical significance whatsoever. Rabbi Akiva lives forever. So, we questioned before, is assimilation an answer? It was not an answer for Paphos, just as it was not an answer for the assimilated Jews of Germany. Hitler found them all. Yimach Shemo. Both Tafos and Rabbi Akiva die, but Rabbi Akiva lives forever. So assimilation cannot be even a physical answer, let alone a spiritual answer. At this stage, I'd like to present you a synopsis of a brilliant essay by Jean-Paul Sartre called Le Portrait d'un Antisémite. It should exist in English translation. I don't know who's published it. The Portrait of an Antisemite, in which he tries to give a picture. He's a philosopher, a major philosopher of the last century. He tries to give a picture of the French anti-Semites. There isn't time to give a full account of the essay, but I will tell you the central thing. He speaks about the Frenchman, who speaks really quite bad French. And the Jew who's arrived in France maybe 20 or 30 years before, his French will be grammatically perfect. He hates that Jew. This Frenchman, who is the typical French anti-Semite, is at best mediocre. But not only is he mediocre, he is proud of being mediocre. He lives within the comfort of the crowds, all the other people who are mediocre, with acceptance of their prejudices. He's afraid of this Jew. This Jew is part of the people of whom Balaam, the non-Jewish prophet, said, Am levadad yishkon. This is a people who dwells in solitudes. And he is extremely afraid of being alone. He's afraid of solitude. He's afraid of those who are alone. He recoils from the genius as much as he recoils from the murderer. Why? Because those who are alone and who are ready to be different, because to be different you have to be alone, they are accusing, they are challenging. J'accuse in French is to challenge. They are challenging. Maybe a person cannot be complacent with his mediocrity. Maybe he has to change. And here is this Jew, recently arrived in the country, speaks perhaps better French than he does. The Jew always suffers from an inferiority complex amongst the nations. So he always somehow strives to float to the top. And he excels in their sciences. And he excels in their, militates in their movements. And somehow or other, he's very noticeable. But he's different. He's alone. He challenges, maybe I ought to be different. And that scares him. So everything which is bad, that's what's different. That's what's alien. The alien menace. The Jew is a symbol. Take away everything that challenges that we have to change. Take away that alien menace. Everything will be perfect. as the Russian says. The Russian said, beat the Jews and save Russia. He doesn't fear the Jew. He fears himself, says Sartre. He fears his conscience. Maybe he cannot accept everything that the crowd endorses. He fears liberty of choice. He fears solitude. He fears change. He hides in the mediocrity of the crowds. And the Jew challenges his comfortable complacency. He fears himself, the anti-Semite. He fears his destiny as a man, his need to make decisions, his need to change. And he really wants to be anything amongst that crowd but a real man. In final analysis, he's almost ambivalent. On the one side, he despises the Jew. And on the other side, he fears the difference. Sartre portrays this perhaps in indelicate fashion. Sartre talks of his attitude to the beautiful Jewish woman. On the one hand, there's a deep sexual attraction. On the other hand, any relationship that he may have with a Jewish woman carries with it an odor of rape. He hates. That hate is compounded of despising, and yet fear that somewhere along the line this Jew may be superior. The same difference. He both despises and he respects. Now at this stage, I'm going to take a look at the analysis of the Talmud of the discussion between Haman and Ahasuerus. And we will see that the sages of the Talmud had already calculated all of Jean-Paul Sartre's thinking many hundreds of years before. The Talmud picks up the words in the arguments. Haman comes to the king Ahasuerus. He says, Yeshno am echad. Those who know Hebrew, Yeshno is an odd word. It ought to be yesh, there is. There is a certain people. And the word has an echo of the Hebrew word meaning yoshen, to sleep. To sleep. So the Talmud projects the discussion between Ahasuerus and Haman, that Haman had to respond to arguments. He came to King Ahasuerus. He said, let's liquidate the Jewish people. Says Ahasuerus, they scare me. I'm afraid, quote number five, I'm afraid of their God. He could do to me what he did to those who preceded me. Nebuchadnezzar, the writing on the wall. To which Haman responds, ah, there's been a major change in the Jewish people. Yashnu, yeshno, yashnu. They've gone to sleep. They no longer keep the commandments of the Torah. They are sleeping in their tradition. At the time of Nebuchadnezzar, there were outstanding figures. There was Daniel. powerful religious symbols. But today, they're all half asleep. They're not keeping the Torah, which made them special. Take notes. That even Haman, who despises the Jew, he sees that they had something special once. To which Ahasuerus says, true, but they have a few Rabbanim, they have a few wise men who still really keep and teach the Torah. Maybe they can turn them. Maybe they can bring them back. To which Haman says, oh, don't bother, statistically, those few sages, they're nothing. As Churchill said, there are lies, damn lies, and statistics. Statistically, they're nothing. They're all one people. And they're completely insignificant amongst this large people. Ahasuerus starts arguing pragmatic arguments. Maybe you'll create an empty space in my kingdom. That's not healthy. We could perhaps be invaded. To which Haman responds, oh, they're scattered all over the place. Completely unproductive. You can see in the text a little more of the explanation. Then says Haman, you think they keep the king's laws? Datehem shonot mikola. They have a completely different legal system. They have completely different habits. They don't belong. They're not integrated. They don't eat what we eat. They eat kosher. They don't marry our daughters. And they don't give us their daughters to marry. They don't keep what everybody else keeps, the laws of labor. You tell them you have to work, they say, can't work today. It's Shabbat today. Oh, it's Pesach today. You've got a 7 or 8 day story. The whole year round, they've got excuses. They're not working. And it really doesn't pay the king to keep them. This is the underlying conversation between Haman and Ahasuerus, which one can read into the verses if one has read this analysis. Doesn't pay the king to keep them because you know what? The Jewish people have an interesting regulation. They have a regulation that they do not drink wine which has been touched by someone who is not Jewish. The source, the origin of this is that in the idolatrous times of Persia and Media, a large part of idol worship involved libations of wine. And at that moment, the sages decreed that the Jews who need their wine very often for purposes of sanctity, the Kiddush on Shabbat, weddings, circumcisions, they use wine on every happy occasion, but on every holy occasion. The decree was, because wine was involved with idolatry, we have to have our own wine. But Haman uses this in an insidious fashion. He says to them, you know what? The Jew who drinks a glass of wine, if a fly falls into the wine, he'll just take it out and he'll carry on drinking. But if the king touches the wine, he'll throw the wine on the ground. Of course, that's an exaggeration. So they're despising the king. They're denigrating the king. And the king wants to keep them. At which point, he says to the king, best is to dispose of them, and the king finally agrees. But if you listen to the undertones, you will hear there are two attitudes. Haman despises this Jewish people, and Ahasuerus, they scare him. These are the ambivalent attitude that Jean-Paul Sartre was painting in his wonderful essay. However, there is one further point. When we're reading the sages, we begin to hear that Ahasuerus, he doesn't fear the Jew because he challenges maybe you ought to be different. He fears the Jew because the Jew carries with him some kind of holiness. They have some kind of hotline to their God. They have some kind of relationship. That scares him. Not just that they are different, but they have a difference which is in the essence of the soul of man. That scares him. And Haman, he's scared of that too. But that was in another generation. They're no longer the same. They've lost their special quality. They're no longer the people, Amra Madad Yishkon, the people who are able to dwell alone. They are half integrated, even though Haman himself argues, yes, but they're half not integrated. But underlying the arguments, one sees that it's not just that this Jew tends to float to the top in all kinds of spheres of society. The problem is that this Jew has within him something, some element of holiness, a contact with God, which is very scary. At this point, I will return to the parable in the Talmud, in quote number 2. We question this peculiar parable, Haman and Ahasuerus. Haman is wishes to pay for the privilege of disposing of the Jews. Ahasuerus says, take the money. Don't need the money. Happy to get rid of them. And the Talmud says, a parable, this can be compared to two people. One has a large mound in his field. One has a large ditch in his field. The owner of the ditch says, oh, I'd be happy to have this mound to fill it in. The owner of the mound says, oh, I'd be grateful for that ditch to dispose of my mound. At a certain moment, the owner of the ditch meets up with the owner of the mound and says, oh, I'm ready to buy your mound. He says, take it, I'll be happy to be rid of it. And we question, what does the parable add to the original story? And the answer says, the Chatam Sofer, an outstanding sage of later generations, lived from 1762 till 1839, was the Rabbi of Pressburg, originally from Frankfurt, an outstanding rabbinical figure. He says exactly what we've been saying up until now. Again, someone who preceded Sartre. Haman and Ahasuerus have two different attitudes to the Jews. Haman is perturbed because he despises them. Despite a bit of ambivalence. Ahasuerus is disturbed because they frighten him. For Ahasuerus, the Jews, the Jewish people, are a mound, a hill. For Haman, there a hole in the ground, a hole in the head. That is the meaning of the parable. But at the end of the day, we see within the sages a much deeper insight than the insight of Sartre, which is certainly valid. We see that their insight demonstrates that the real root of anti-Semitism may well be the special relationship that the Jewish people have with God. It's stated in quote number 6. It's perhaps stated more explicitly, why is the mountain of Sinai called Sinai? The Hebrew word for Sinai is Sinai. The Hebrew word for hate is Sinah. Because at the time the Torah was given to the Jewish people at Sinai, hate for the Jewish people descended to the nations of the world. The problem is that we live in a world where on the one hand the Jew is hated and despised, but on the other hand this is a world which prides itself on the Ten Commandments. Where did that come from? That came from the Jewish people. The three great religions with monotheism, where did that come from? It all came from Abraham. The Ten Commandments are still significant. They were significant enough for Hollywood to make a film of the Ten Commandments. Despite the fact that when you take a look, when you take a close look, you will find that a lot of the commandments have been discarded. The world has discarded a Sabbath. The world has discarded thou shalt not commit adultery. Even the Kinsey Report, and we are going back almost into the Middle Ages when we speak of the Kinsey Report. Situation in modern society is grave, yet nevertheless, we still protest. We have the Ten Commandments. Thou shalt not covet. We live in a society dominated by stock exchange elements, where the order of the day is swallowing up smaller companies. Thou shalt not covet. But still, the Ten Commandments is still a symbol. It's a symbol of the limited amount of civilization which the present day world possesses. I'll conclude with a statement of an American clergyman called John James Holmes, an outstanding clergyman, who died in 1964. He stated the following in a sermon in the Community Church in New York City, January the 17th, 1943. Such is the debt which Christianity owes to Judaism. Not Jesus merely, who of course was Jewish, nor the Bible, the church, parallel to the synagogue, and the Sunday, but the whole substance of Christian teaching. We find here an explanation, at least, and a very important one, of why the Christians dislike and persecute the Jews. They hate them and would get rid of them because they are heavily indebted to them. This is a very simple law of psychology. I'll conclude with another quote. Nicholas Berdyaev, a Russian religious philosopher of the communist period, died in 1948. He writes, of course, in Russian, "The saddest thing to admit is that those who rejected the cross have to carry it, while those who welcomed it so often engaged in crucifying others."